And I'm very, very delighted to welcome Professor Tim Unwin to speak to us today. He's actually, we're very lucky, he's just jetting in to join us, actually. So he's just informed me he's visited 4 countries in the last 5 days. So he's still kind
of... That's not a good thing,
by the way. It's probably not a good thing in terms of the jet lag. But we're very grateful he's found the time in his very busy schedule to come and speak to us today. Tim is the CEO of the CTO, Commonwealth Telecommunications Organisation, and he's Emeritus Professor of Geography at Royal Holloway College in London. He's also Chair of the Commonwealth Scholarship Commission, and as many of you probably know, he's UNESCO Chair in ICT4D, and a well-known expert in that field, very well published, and a consultant in that area as well. He's recently done some work on mobile learning in China, amongst many other projects, which I expect he will refer to during the talk. Fair enough. He's also done extensive work on creating and developing partnerships to deliver educational initiatives using ICT in Africa and in other countries as well. He's directed the World Economic Forum's Partnerships for Education program with UNESCO, for example, and for that, leading DFID's InfoGov initiative. So he's got a very lengthy history behind him. I've only touched on some of it, I'm afraid. But just gives you a flavor. So welcome, Tim. And
I think you know that's 10 minutes, so I have to reduce my. Thanks ever so much for inviting me. If I go to sleep during this presentation, you'll know why. It's wonderful to be here, partly with a Commonwealth hat, but also to sort of just have an opportunity to reflect on some of the challenges that I've been facing in recent years. And to get your feedback and eyes. The plan is that I'm going to talk for about 20 minutes, and then there's going to be a little interlude, and I'm not sure who's actually going to choreograph this, whether it's you or me, but we can see how it goes. And then a second half as well. But we were sort of exploring what I should talk about out of all that rubbish. You know, I hate experts and I hate consultants. You know, apologies if any of you think you are experts and consultants. I will leave now. But really, the plan was to talk a little bit generically about technology and development. And I think, you know, I've oscillated. Sometimes I'm really passionate that, yes, we can do great things, and other times I'm in a slough of despair and think this is just a complete conspiracy. And I think you're going to rather get the conspiracy view this evening. So that you can say, but no, what we're doing is brilliant and marvellous. And then the idea for this talk was really to say, well, you know, to what extent is much of the work that's been done so far on open education resources actually just paralleling that bigger, broader agenda? Or are open education resources actually doing something different? So we're in a school in Zambia. And particularly given the Zambian connection, I would just sort of get us in the mood for that hot, balmy, wonderful place. And Center for Professional Training for Teachers there. I think this is one of my favorite all-time African posters, Women and Girls of Equal Rights as Men and Boys to Education. And you know, moving through to the very ambitious goals that Zambia has for being a middle-income country by 2030. And what does that mean? And what does education actually have to contribute to that? So as I said, 2 main themes. So this was going to be a nice Prezi until I discovered that half of my image files were TIFF. And if any of you don't know, a lesson you can take away now, TIFF files don't show up on Prezi. So you're going to have to... And then we even tried to get it a little more interactive, and that didn't work either. So you've got me stuck here, and I think the cameraman would be grateful that I don't jump around too much. So the 2 main themes, the concept of technology and development, and the fundamental question, in whose interests is that? And I think I'm shifting, actually it's much more in our interests, that there are real difficulties in we were talking earlier about, actually this is going out live, I'd better be a little more diplomatic. There are some global corporations that have some wonderful programs for learning and teaching in poor countries. And they think that this has an important impact that is actually going to help deliver on some of those educational goals. And so then moving on to sort of challenging of implementing open education resources. And getting us to think, you know, really tough questions. Why are we interested in doing that? Whose interests are these OERs? And I want to share sort of the pitfalls that I've been suffering from in the last 10 years. And I guess you will parallel some of those. I hope there may be 1 or 2 that you may not have thought of and that they can help you move forward with some of the projects that you're working on. Those of you who've heard some of my talks before will probably be familiar with one or two of these slides, but I put this one on to begin with just to remind us that the ICTs are very, very diverse. I was in the US recently, and a wonderful old gentleman, whose name I've forgotten, came up to me, and he said, "Tim, I was doing this with radios 50 years ago." And actually, he's right, that for much of Africa, radios are still a brilliant solution, and we forget about them. And if we're really dealing with the poor, and going back to in whose interests, personal computers with internet access, high-cost individual technologies, are they necessarily the right kind of technology? And I think we can think of all, we can play around with these in different countries, different contexts, there in different places. But I like to think, and yes, this is from my book, so it's about 3 or 4 years old, but we can think of technologies as being individual or communal, and there's an interest there. We can think of technology in terms of the ease of use and cost. And by and large, high ease of access, low cost to end user, and more communal are the sorts of things we're not tending to use in education as much as we should be. So some work beginning to be done in mobile learning, some very exciting work, but again, full of challenges and problems. So there is this view that ICTs can transform development. And I think it goes in a nutshell, and what we can do with our mobile devices. It goes something like this, that ICTs are part and parcel of the globalization that is happening. ICTs have enabled us to bank 24/7, to shift capital around the world very, very much more rapidly, and so it can circulate positively and negatively. And ICTs have enabled that. So why can't ICTs, therefore, help the poorest and the most marginalized? The technology, all of those technologies we've spoken about, are hugely powerful. As a geographer, as a background, and I'm not going to be too theoretical tonight, but one day I'll have to give a really esoteric seminar about the nature of space-time and relativity and ICT for development. But you can see why I'm interested in that. And we're familiar with the work of Manuel Castells, who argues that the circularity, the reciprocity enables us to be in a completely new age. I think he's wrong. Okay, for those of you who support Castells, I actually think the drivers of this information age haven't changed very much from what they were in the 19th century in terms of industrial capital. I mean, think of what email is. Think about what e-learning is. It's a brilliant, it's introduced to enable labor to extend the working hour for the same amount of wages. That you can have your e-learning course that you don't do in the work time, but you do in the evening at home. So it's a way of capital exploiting labor. It's some of the... Actually, I'm going to come across as a bit of an unreconstructed Trotskyist this evening, but it's true. I think many of those same fundamental underlying principles are still there. And so the argument goes that surely this kit can contribute to development. And I think those of us who have some kind of moral conscience, and development is not about economic growth, it's about moral ideas, believe, okay, we've got this, how can we do it? And if you go back to the early days of schools in Africa and education swaps and computers in schools, the early driver was people who'd experienced the use of computers in schools in richer countries. And so now our computer's dead, we're going to go on to move the new one. Surely there's some advantage in giving this fantastic kit because we've benefited from it for schools in Africa. And some of the origin, talking to the pioneers, some fantastic things were done. But again, I come back to saying, in whose interests? And this is perhaps where the mobile phones come in, bringing in just some graphics, because I think this helps really show the story. Dominated, of course, by this explosion of mobile telephony. As gradual growth of internet users. So these technologies are expanding. The question is, how can we use this? What can we do with this device for learning or this device? And so we have, if you like, ICTs as a solution for development. Technology can transform things. And I'm not arguing at all that everything has been negative and bad. Undoubtedly, there are some really interesting developments. But the case I want to try and make to you is that is not systematically in the interests of the poorest people. And if we do want to do things that are going to make a difference to the poorest, how do we go about it? Because I have an absolutely passionate belief that academics are not just responsible for the rich and the powerful. I happen to believe that we should be more responsible for those who are less privileged than we are and who need us much, much more than do some of the richest. I think a second real driver in this, and again, I don't think the story's been told anything like visually enough and graphically enough, but the ways in which the Millennium Development Goal process transpired, particularly MDG 8, and which was really a catch-all. You know, what else could we put into there that we've forgotten about after education and health and environment? But in there was, of course, this element that partnerships and technology, and the two would go hand in hand. So embedded in what's become, if you like, the dominant leitmotif of development rhetoric is this notion that technology and development go together. And the way in which the private sector in particular influenced that debate in the 1990s is a story that's insufficiently told. I think the role of the private sector in the development of WISIS process and the dot force and things like that, that is clearly there. But it goes back to the 1990s. And certain key individuals and meetings between some of the leaders of global corporations and prime ministers and presidents in Western Europe and North America. There is a fascinating story that somebody needs to map out. But you may say this is, let's take Trotsky out of it, and let's say, and I'm being very crude Marxist here, but it's driven fundamentally by the interests of capital. And we forget too much that this is about expanding the market. Microsoft is nothing to do with education. If it was, it wouldn't be called Microsoft Office, it would be called Microsoft Education or something. You know, Microsoft is interested in two basic products, an operating system and a suite of Office software. And yet, you know, they make a huge case that yes, this is going to transform education. And why? To expand the market. And secondly, obviously, to reduce costs of production. And just bleeding, if you like, into open education resources. Think why that might be important. And open education and reduce costs of production for whom? Who's actually going to benefit? And I think, so if we say a transformative power of technology is part of the solution for development, the importance of MDG 8, drivers of capital, but also this search for a silver bullet. Why are we so still caught up in this idea that there is going to be something simple that will solve the world's problems? And it's going to be technology that will enable development to take place. And we could go tangentially off here. So I said I'd get sidetracked, but this is a nice sidetrack. We talk about the fight against poverty. Why this rhetoric? You know, bullets, fights against poverty. I mean, it actually goes back to the US again in the immediate post-war period. But if we're about working together collaboratively, we have to change our rhetorics. So if ever you find yourself talking about, you know, the fight against poverty or silver bullets, let's actually think of a different vocabulary. Because I think language and words are incredibly important. That, of course, is all a highly instrumentalist view. And so what I really want to try and get us to think about is why this is kind of dangerous. And I like that sort of graphic, but we could use others. And quite simply, technology is seen as being something neutral. Why is that? And as being neutral, it can be used to change the world primarily for the better. All too rarely do we actually think about how is technology making the world less good. And we touched on emails, and emails are the worst thing ever for productivity and innovation. They constrain us. How do you cope with that intray? Because historically, technologies have always been used by those in power to maintain their positions of power. Why should ICTs be any different? Why do we naively think they can actually change the relations of production and the nature of the system of which we are part? Can technologies change power relationships? And I undoubtedly used to believe passionately that they could 10, 15 years ago. And I think maybe 10, 15 years ago, they could have done. Maybe I'm just naive. And again, there's a different seminar that could come in here. I don't know if any of you have seen the debate we had at the ICTD 2012 conference in Atlanta, which is on video, which was actually there about social media and whether it was social media that really enabled some of the things to happen in North Africa in the so-called Arab Spring. And there was a vote at the end of it, which actually was pretty much, it was 51%, 49%. But you know, all the evidence is actually that even the anarchic potential of the web has now been so taken over by global corporates and states that window of opportunity is not as large as it once was. And I think, you know, if we begin to move in this direction, we have to really think about the nature of the research we're doing and our practice. And research being, you know, about what kinds of understandings do we need to put in place to subvert some of those processes. And looking at you, some of you may be PhD students, and I think you have a real challenge, because what can you do of value in a PhD that has between 6 months and a year in the field, or any academic research project, particularly in the field of education, where educational change takes a much, much longer time period. But we could come back to that. Let me very briefly move into a little bit of thinking about the nature of development. I don't know if you've read any of Eric Hirschman's blogs of late, but he made a very powerful argument that most of us working in the field of technology and development tended to be quite patronizing, and it was, you know, middle-aged white men, you know, using technology to give there to poor black people in Africa. She is not in Africa. She's on a street in Dublin. We have poverty here. The arguments I'm making here, I think, are very much about our own societies as they are elsewhere. But very briefly, we have to move away, and this is the case I'm making, from seeing development purely as being about economic growth. And you're familiar with these, but it is extraordinary that people still believe that economic growth is going to eliminate poverty. I mean, there is enough good research out there, so there's an absolutely crass view of the world. But again, it's a view propagated because certain people have particular interests in there, and it's built on an absolute model of poverty rather than on a relative model of poverty. And note how after early 90s, this got sort of caught up in the world of kind of liberal democracy and economic growth go hand in hand. And people believe this rubbish. You know, where is biggest economic growth in the world at the moment? It isn't in the liberal democracies. And you know, I had the privilege of spending 3 months in China last year. And you know, absolutely fantastic, great changes taking place. So even alternatives proposed by academics have their own challenges and problems. And again, each of these bullet lines is a paper or a seminar or both. There are alternatives that are widely out there. Why aren't we using them more? I think in the field of ICT for development, SEND's capabilities approach has become very popular. The notion of individual freedoms, agendas around social equity, redistributive plans of wealth. I mean, Britain is today more unequal and divided in terms of economic power than it has been at any time since 1918. You know, the richest 1,000 compared with the poorest. Extraordinary. These arguments are as at home here as they are elsewhere. And political freedoms and the nature of so-called democracy. I mean, David Held's work, you know, there are many different kinds of democracy. Some democracies allow people to be executed. I find that challenging. So the point here, and we've only been 15 minutes, we're doing well. It's 3.5 minutes till your break, and you have to do an exercise. But each of these models, whether it's SEN, whether it's some of the radical alternatives, is underlain by particular interests. And this is in, so I apologize, people here work in Tanzania that don't have pictures of Tanzania here. This is Uganda. But I like this in the orphanage because there's some fantastic work about best use of technology is actually in prayer, but that's, again, another seminar. We have to think, who is it who's really going to benefit from that economic growth agenda? And the case, and I see some smiles around the room, so I'm not totally alone in thinking that probably isn't in the interests of the poorest and the most marginalized. Trickle-down solutions don't work. All the work, on one little example of this, take rural areas. There's a huge amount of work on mobile phones to enable people to find out prices of cereals or whatever they're producing so they can sell it in the market. Well, yeah, two real fundamental problems with that. One is the poorest people do not produce their own food. They're landless labourers. So what are we doing about using mobile technologies to support the learning of landless labourers? And secondly, if you can't transport your goods to where the best value market is, actually there's not much point in having that information because you're going to get really stressed. So we're not even some of the sort of really best ideas don't necessarily deliver for the poorest. Take the notion of freedoms. And this is perhaps where this comes in. Who is truly free? And I think one of the fundamental problems with all of the work that's been done around Sen's model is, I'm an unreconstructed structuralist, but it ignores the structures that prevent people having the freedoms that they like to believe they have. And ultimately, in the nature of society, we have freedoms means the freedom to sell your labour power, which isn't necessarily in your own interests, but we could get out of it. And then even those of us who might believe in violent political change, look at what's been happening. Again, let's take North Africa. Who is really representing the poorest? Now, what was happening in North Africa, wasn't the poorest, most marginalised people. If you could say it was a Facebook revolution, the poorest people didn't have access to Facebook. They didn't have the mobile devices to enable them to do this. So even if, who is representing the poorest? And of course, you can see where my argument is going. It's our responsibility to do that. Academics, we are, if you like, the psychoanalysts of society. It is our job to reveal the contradictions in society and provide alternatives for society to make choices. We live in an unequal world. We have to do something about that. And for all of you who love European research grants, I was doing some background work recently, and Europe is what would be the most competitive knowledge society. It's not at all in our interests to enable African or Asian or other societies actually to get anywhere near us. It's all competitive. And I really have doubts as to whether this is what I would see as being development. So the fundamental challenge is how we can ensure the benefits of economic growth are fairly distributed. Again, I think that raises what is indeed fair. And two pictures from China. It's in Shenzhen. Incredible. You can buy any technology kit you want. But how is that influencing and a complex picture here? A beggar who's got damaged legs pushing his life possessions on a trolley, and you can see the stick of the blind person also walking along behind. How are we using our skills and expertise to support them, at least as much as, let's say, them? Now, all of that is underlain by a kind of theoretical perspectives. If we had more time, we'd go into that in great detail. But I've always been heavily influenced by Jürgen Habermas's work. And the point that I really want to sort of allude to is this technical interest of most empirical analytic science. And those of us who are computer scientists, that's particularly pertinent too. But for anyone who knows Habermas's work, he also argues that much historical hermeneutic science still doesn't actually enable us to change the conditions that are constraining us, let's say, as along the lines I was saying before. And the point I come back to, and we're about to take a short break, is that how do we get around that problem? If we believe that technologies for development are actually about changing power relationships, what do we do about it? As I said, I think ICTs have that potential, these modern ICTs. This is why Tim Berners-Lee's campaign to keep the web free and open, not to be moving to a two-speed, two-tier, privileged, unprivileged web, are actually so important. And as I said earlier, mobile telephony, the web, are generally seen as being disruptive. But in the last couple of years in particular, I'm getting more and more worried, because who has the ultimate control? And a question I'm increasingly thinking about is actually, who do you want to have all of your biodata? Your fingerprints, your retinal scan, your bank accounts, everything you've ever done. Google has most of it on its servers. And even, you know, I was saying earlier, I've got a wonderful new Huawei Notepad, 7 inches. Now, that's the future. When you can roll that up and scrumple it and put it in your pocket and everybody has one, cool. But I couldn't download any apps without a Gmail account. And I've never had a Gmail account. I managed to resist it completely, but I needed to learn how to use Android. I had to have a Gmail account. Or governments. And this is where, you know, actually the CTO's interest in cybersecurity is particularly pertinent. And yeah, maybe we think in this country our government is reasonably benign. But some of you are from South Asia. And I remember a year and a half ago at a conference there raising doubts about the Indian government's proposals to give everybody a number that all of their identity will be on, they'll be able to use everything. Isn't that wonderful? You know, you don't have to have all the bits of paper. You get rid of all the damage of bureaucracy and the corruption involved in that. But, hey, I don't know if you've had a problem. My address, you know, when you type in your postcode into anything online, it comes up with your automatic address. Well, my address is wrong on that. You type in the postcode. I cannot get my correct address. And I've written to them and tried to change it many times. I've given up. It's impossible. But you know, imagine you get a bit of DNA wrong in the stream somewhere there. Or you know, the insurance company also has access to that. And they know you're going to die in X years' time. And so you have to pay more for your premiums. You know, this is the reality of the world in which we're living. What are we going to do about it? So I think that those of us working in this field have to still hold on to the belief that this technology can change societies for the better. But what do we do about it? And why am I so scared? Developed world, developing world, less developed countries. And whichever kind of technology you look at, the gap in equality is greater now than it was 10 years ago. And what is deeply worrying here is that that curve is leveling off just as much as that one is. So the least developed countries are becoming more unequal and less benefiting. If you take it to greater extremes, this is internet use. And you talk about using the internet for open education resources, to access the mobile broadband. Get real. Maybe. So I hope I've just at least raised a doubt in your mind that this technology that we love and care so much about and believe can make a difference is actually leading to greater inequalities rather than lessening them. And that, you know, we could show graphs. It's not just between countries, between rural and urban areas, and between different people, people with different abilities, people from different ethnic backgrounds, people of different genders, however we look at it. And technology, I don't think, is neutral. Okay, that's 24 minutes, so that's 4 minutes over. But let's take an interlude. You've been very kind and patient, bit of smile. But the idea was to have 2 or 3 minutes. You just talk to your neighbour and introduce yourself if you don't know each other, or get up if you know the person sitting next to you. This is meant to be interactive. Is this right, guys? Yes, what you want them to do? And just sort of 2 or 3 minutes and think, okay, from what I'm saying, and those of you who are interested in open education resources, you know, what are the implications of some of those arguments for our use of OER? Yeah? You perhaps won't go to sleep. So much of the last 10 to 15 years, I've been interested in actually how we can develop collaborative resources for learners and teachers to use, mainly in higher education, and also, I think, you know, Bjorn and others know, so do some experiments in storytelling, and if there'd be more time, I'd love to show you some videos of that. But what I want to try and do is now move some of the deliberately provocative, so don't believe quite everything that I said, so that's particularly for the camera, you know, don't cite me on this, as CEO of the CTO said that. But really to explore some of the things we've tried to do, not say too much about that, but I'm a great believer that we learn much more from our failures than from our successes. So really talk about some of the areas where things didn't go quite as we would have liked. And I think, you know, the answer is always, well, you ought to have known that they weren't going to go right, but we're all on a learning journey. And then at the end, come back to some things that might make a difference. And I think, yeah, the first thing I'd like to say is a really fundamental difference between openness and freedoms. Openness on the one hand and freedoms. But people tend to elide the two together. Openness and David's work and others, and there's a tangent here. We could go on talking a lot about open source in terms of software, but focusing very much on content. You know, the standard 4Rs framework that open content means it can be reused, it can be revised, it can be remixed and redistributed. The notion that we can develop collaborative resources that we can build on and will be valuable in their own right. But that, although related, is totally different from free. And yet the two, I think, seem to be used together. The real issue is that everything has a real cost of production. And we have to use the sort of notion of free for end user, not actually free. And this issue is all too often ignored, because the costs of producing open educational, it might be fine for the bourgeoisie in Western universities who, in their evenings, self-exploit and or perhaps even worse, and actually use the resources they've been contracted to develop for their institution, then do a bit of sidelining or moonlighting and actually take those and make those available to others for free. But there is a cost in production. And part of the challenge, I think, in the OER movement is that that is forgotten, and people are encouraged to try and develop OER. And people don't think, well, how are we going to pay for that content to be done? Why on earth should a teacher, who has about 7 different jobs anyway to keep alive and keep the family alive, spend extra time working collaboratively to make resources that other people are going to use? Let's get real, perhaps. And I touched on this, and I could go and talk about RM a lot, but I think the parallels are, of course, very close with the four freedoms. We could say more about that, but in view of the time, I'm not going to. And there are ways in which all of this can get licensed, I'm sure we're familiar with, but I actually can't name those 6 different licenses within the Creative Commons framework. And I actually don't use Creative Commons myself, because I think Creative Commons is quite constraining. I actually make mine just anyone can do. I've long since had story time. I remember I once taught what I thought was an innovative course in a university, and was then asked to go. Other universities had schemes whereby you have to get approval for new courses. You get outside people in. And so I actually had to, someone was putting forward a course which was almost exactly the same as my course in this other university. And I was really upset. Isn't that sad? Why was I upset? Shouldn't have been. We're privileged in our universities, which should still be free. That's another story. But we are paid to generate knowledge. Why isn't that made completely available for anybody? Big questions. So let's drill down a little bit in more detail. There are many different definitions of open education resources. I'm assuming that everybody here is familiar. But this is from the UNESCO wiki, and note we've open education resources. Okay, we have the freedom and the openness, use and reuse, teaching, learning, and research. Research, some of us might quibble with. Intellectual property issues around this. Last decade, most definitions agree that content, software, tools, licenses, and best practice are included. Right at the end, I'm going to come back to a fundamental challenge with that definition, particularly for learning, but we'll stick with it for the moment. And I think, I'm taking it for granted that many of us see there are huge benefits in OER. Just noting a few, and this is again taken from the OER wiki, just 4 that I think are particularly important. The cost issue can help counter the rising costs of developing educational programs. We can actually, if we make this open content freely available. How many of us? Now, most people in this room, I guess, the leading people in the world probably at a university like this. Don't we believe that actually what we're doing is cutting edge? We don't want to use somebody else's text. We're going to develop our own courses. Or isn't that any longer the case? So I think there are tricky issues around that. But for poor countries, this is a way to reduce costs. The collaborative models actually enable community of practices to emerge and develop, and out of collaboration, you get better content. No one of us can produce the quality of content that a team of us working together can. Using particular licenses can mean that users don't have to go and worry as to whether they photocopy a bit or not, and you know it is there. You can just use it without any concerns that some external force is going to come down and whack a legal claim against you. And actually, if we build this community, that the institutions, you know, MIT, individuals creating publishing are awarded through increased status and visibility. And again, you can begin to see where some of the tensions come in. It's all very well for an academic who's got a nice pay, or a software developer who's working for a company and getting huge amounts of money to actually get a little bit of extra status. Yeah, that's very nice. And I'm giving open content there. I'm making my stuff. I can afford to. Well, who's going to reward the teacher that I showed you in an earlier slide? That having been said, there are also some fantastic programs out there, most of which are unknown. How many of us have actually used anything from UNESCO's Open Training Platform? One. Interesting, but there is some remarkable, and actually the quality of some of the content there, in terms of teacher notes and in terms of the visuals, are very, very good. I guess everyone, most people are familiar with the OER Africa movement, which has really championed some of these things, and has evolved, and Neil Butcher's work here, has evolved, I think, from rather tentative starts. Huge challenges in actually going there. Now, these data are a year and a half out of date, but I want to come back and get a thing. Well, who is involved in these initiatives? Going back to that question I began with, whose interests are they being done? And if we look at most of them, they're usually led by people from North America and Europe. How many do we know that are actually led from Guatemala or Bangladesh? Some are, but this is the UNESCO OER community member distribution there. And certainly, in terms of active participation, most active participation is still, in 2012, 10 years after OER was initially, open content was thought about. And I don't know how many of you are involved in some of these groups. I've got myself off almost every group I was ever on. How on earth do people have the time to engage in this? And most of the conversation, I'm being a little bit naughty, but it's completely crass and a complete waste of time. It doesn't actually lead to the wonderful collective genre that we would like to have. Why not? Why not? And what can we do about it to actually change that? Because surely this technology, this powerful technology, which enables us to collaborate effectively and in new ways, I, alluding to what I'm going to say at the end, I think that's because we've focused on content rather than communication. Open content rather than open communication. And even here, Sub-Saharan Africa is like 16%. That's almost all South Africa. And my interest over the last decade has been primarily in Africa. Let's look at a couple of years ago, a year and a half ago, look at the UNESCO OER story providers, where they come from. I think this is very much making my point. You can refute it. There are other cases. OER Africa is a little bit better, but a lot of the resources there are from South Africa or indeed outside. We even look at the Wiki Educator projects, and this was taken from the All Countries page. Africa is hugely present there. So what I'm trying to begin to get us to think, is OER therefore just another top-down elitist conspiracy? I think there are some grounds that it is. And much of that is based on our mainly academics who are pressured in terms of, they haven't much time to get out of the field and do the research that they would love to do, but they also love teaching, and they have administrators who tell them they've got to get, RAE or REF now, status grants and publications in. We're being squeezed even if we want to try and deliver on this. So the sorts of reasons why OER is seen as being valuable in an African context, that just ain't no content. I remember when I was in DFID, all school textbooks are virtually, as exaggeration, a lot of school textbooks in Africa are funded by donors. And I tried to get them to say, because the publishers exist only because of donor money coming in, that if only, well, why do you make, for every 10 books you sell, just put digital content freely available as well? At least you could get that free digital content out, because the donors are paying for it. I mean, I didn't succeed, but that's a campaign I would love to go on. It's actually incredibly expensive for learning or training in much of Africa. How can we reduce those costs? And of course, you know, the teaching in schools in Africa is dreadful, isn't it? I mean, it really is dire. Teachers don't know how to teach. They haven't been trained properly. There are 40,000 untrained teachers in Ghana who just haven't a clue. They've got to be given a course in how to use technology to transform the world as a silver bullet. Sorry, some of you look a bit serious. I didn't mean what I said in terms of teachers in Africa are useless. Far from it. They know how to teach. They have to deal with it, a lot of them. And the infrastructures aren't there. Actually, sorry. Note that camera. The pathos. No, there's not the infrastructure to enable education to take place effectively. And actually, people don't understand about technology. These are drawn from the literature and from some of our experiences. And what I want to do in the last sort of 10 minutes, really, is share some of the experiences we've been involved in through a Delphi-funded project, an EduLink-funded project, and work we've tried to do through the collective. And just sort of some insights and pieces. In essence, what we were interested in doing through all of those projects in one form or another was building shared capacity, building our capacity, European colleagues' capacity, as well as African capacity, in how we can use ICTs in education and training, learning, delivery, particularly at universities and particularly in building kind of open content. And the sorts of things we were doing were fairly standard, I think, but exchange visits, workshops, actually some substantial periods of time that we would spend in each other's countries. And the deal was, if you went to another country, you had to develop content with them that would then be fed back into the pool. And we're also doing some research on learning management systems and on partnerships and other things as well. And the next slide is going to show what one of the best bits of content that came out of the research that we did. Oh, sorry, the content that was developed during the those exchange visits. Incredibly difficult, actually, to get content developed. The environments were hugely problematic. And actually, Tanzania. So I forgot it said Tanzania on that. So this was a Tanzanian colleague who came and worked with us and did a series of wonderful PowerPoint presentations. But that's a little different from perhaps some MIT courseware. Is this necessarily much better? I think that's a huge question we have to ask. Certainly in my own parent discipline, if you like, the stuff you could get off that for geography was not worth the download time. But we used ELG to develop sharing content and development. Yeah, is that necessarily any better? This didn't work. Actually, developing collaboratively online networks to develop shared content really didn't work particularly successfully at all. But it was fun, and you know, the geek in me loves doing sorts of things like that. Anyone had success with ELG or Ning? Really get collaboration going? Interesting. Now, why not? And really, you know, the next couple of slides, why not? And then what I think some of the real challenges were. All too often, it's physical infrastructures that are blamed. For example, the lack of bandwidth. You can't connect. Or the lack of electricity. Things go down, no generators. But actually, most universities, there's some electricity. Lack of computers. Yeah, well, you know, anyone from Makerere or no Makerere here? And the computer lab in Makerere, you know, computer labs with 700 computers in. Hey, can you imagine teaching in that? And the explosion of mobile telephony, you know, what can we do on our mobile phones? The cost of software, but actually, you know, it's either pirated or it's free or it's FOSS or whatever. So that's not really very expensive. I don't think those are the real issues. They're the ones that are catalogued out most often. And in any ways, as I've tried to very swiftly allude, those are pretty much being overcome. Our biggest challenges, and this slide is in due respect to two immense African colleagues who I love dearly, you know, Boubacar Barry and Joffas Anamuo Mensah, from whom I learnt a phenomenal amount. Our biggest challenge was, in any education initiative, changes in personnel. Now, you have charismatic leaders who then go on and do something else, the project fails. Diversity of funding mechanism. I think this is a huge challenge in development more generally, but the building up of dependent mentalities. A visiting fellow from another country, not in Africa, we had she was with us for a couple of months, and this was, yeah, just transforming everything that was happening in her country. Everything was looking for when the next grant was coming. So if you come with a nice OER grant, yes, lovely, we'll do OER with you. Well, wonderful. As soon as that money comes, it's really the next big thing. Aren't we actually, though, a bit like that in our universities today? You know, we've got to have the next ESRC grant, and we've got to have full economic costing. The time commitments. They're huge to develop good content. I mean, hey, we should know that. How are some of our colleagues in African universities going to do that? We don't understand each other's languages. It took us a year to realize that actually we were all using ICT for development in completely different ways. I exaggerated it. It took about 4 months. But the impact, you know, for many people, it was just about getting computer labs into their institutions, because a computer lab carried status with it. And you know, you could gift that out. I'm beginning to touch on really sensitive issues here, and probably not going to be able to have a health warning. But in many institutions, I don't know, did any of us teachers ever sell our notes or charge people for photocopying our notes so that the students could have them? Or don't we, if we use one of these, you know, photocopyings, we actually get some money? If you're getting individual benefit from teaching, if you're selling your lecture notes as a way of income, or if you're going to use those lecture notes to write a book from which you're going to get money, and you need that money, of course, British academics or people working in British universities don't need that. I mean, let's not sully ourselves with it, please. You know, we don't get paid for books. It doesn't matter. We're contributing for knowledge. But if you can get, you know, money from your book and it enables you to do something else at home, yeah, there is a huge, huge issue there that we all too often don't talk about. I'm running over time. I apologize. The second one of challenges, I think the explosion of new private universities and the implications of that in the African context are huge, and you're actually paying for things. The traditional didactic model of teaching, the individual, and US and individualism, which, you know, rather than the, let's say, European-ish more communal work, or the African emphasis on communal. Remember that individual communal slide at the beginning, where the world is dominated by US and individualism, and that's all that matters. That is a real challenge. I've touched on, but what is the role of a teacher? We talk about that in schools. We talk about the need to move from teacher to facilitator. But isn't that even more of a challenge at university? If you're going to give your knowledge away for free, doesn't that raise issues? So I could talk great length about that. I probably won't. But the move from state funding of universities, I'd read is, so if you like, the payment flows. But basically, this is a traditional model that academics publish journals which they don't get any money for anything. We now actually have to pay. You know, we have to pay to get our articles published in journals. The reversal here. Who's actually benefiting? But essentially, yeah, OER is a complete change of system and structure in which there are huge interests in that model, very, very few interests there. But I can come back and talk about that. And I think rather than saying one is better than the other, we have to begin to think about the positive and the negatives of both open and proprietary, and then think about actually how we can integrate these to deliver solutions that are context specific. And I've just, from our experiences, highlighted some of the things here. And a lot are can, and that's, I think, where I go back to my kind of structuralist perspective. What are the conditions that enable that can to be yes or no? And again, I think a lot of our work isn't sufficiently addressing those. So in terms of open, can be hugely better value for money. Excellent solution in theory. We're working, developing collaborative resources. But in reality, yeah, there aren't many universities in this country that really encourage collaborative development of learning resources. I'm being thrown out with the rubbish. It builds on multiple knowledges. It can be reused. It can be very, very bottom-up. And it can be communal. But you know, less collaboration in practice, huge skills needed to localize. And that MIT coursework, can you imagine localizing that for a small university in a primarily rural part of Africa where we're working? Ultimately, how do we pay for that? Who is going to pay for open education resources in some of the poorer countries where we're working? Somebody has to, because it's not... Sorry, I touched the screen. I probably shouldn't have done that. It can't be funded by grants forever. There has to be a generation of income. There remain challenges over accreditation, and licensing remains hugely complex. And proprietary. It can be designed to suit particular needs. I think in leading excellent research-driven universities that are going to be at the cutting edge, we can teach courses more or less on what we want. They are going to be moving that knowledge forward. We can, therefore, proprietary, we're paid. The quality is assured by experts. It's certificated, and as you all know, certification is such a huge issue in much of the world where we work. And the negatives, often mass-produced, top-down. So there are both good and bad. So what are the implications? I think, drawing to an end, we need to think about actually what solution we want and how to deliver it. It isn't surprising that proprietary providers are still so successful. They may well cost more, but generally guarantee quality. And I was thinking about this, but actually one can make complaints against poor delivery. If you're paying for it and it's not delivered, then you can have some feedback. And the certification. Open solutions, real challenges over some of the quality. We need the hardware to make it work effectively. The 7-inch roll-up, fantastic device. Let me just have some conclusions. And my interests with young out-of-school youth in Ethiopia or wherever. To me, and in my experiences over the last decade, I think most OER has tended to suffer from just the same challenges I said in the first half of the lecture. I think the challenges that we have to overcome are being externally driven, being top-down, understanding user needs, and undermining existing structures and initiatives. If you come in offering free resources, open and collaborative resources, that is so alien to the intellectual and financial environments, they're not going to succeed. But I still believe, just like I believe the technology can be disruptive, that OER have an immense amount to offer. Because that's actually why 30 years ago I entered academia in the first place. We were developing, sharing ideas, moving knowledge forward collaboratively. What a shame that world has changed as much as it has. But the final point is that content isn't actually what learning and education are about at all. There's so much content out there. You can download it. There's far too much. The skill we need for our young people and our old people to learn is actually what is good information and what is less good information. And real learning is going back to that school and that tree in the beginning slide I showed. Real learning is having an inspirational teacher. somebody who will share their experiences, will help you, me, develop our own understandings of the world in which we live and what we're going to do about it. Real learning is about communication much more than about content, which is why if I hadn't taken on this job, and my final slide, that's really what I would be working on. It's about enabling people all across the world using this incredible technology to interact. The best older minds, the best younger minds, to communicate. It's not about content. It's not about content. So all this OER, there is so much free content there already. Actually, changing the world of learning and education is about enabling that interaction that is so precious and can be mediated through technology to be brought back to life again. Thank you for inviting me. I went on a bit longer. I'm sorry. But I hope I've challenged you a bit and we can have an opportunity to discuss and talk about some of these issues. Pleasure to be with you.